size. Jim Collins includes a note as to where on the audio recording of the meeting you can find comments. So last time we had a fairly lengthy discussion about allocation of our appropriation principles and where we ought to do and how we ought to do it. A lot of people commented. It was a great discussion. It was a lengthy discussion, but the discussion itself isn't captured in the meeting notes. But it is on the audio, and I'd encourage you to go to our website and listen to the audio anytime you want to follow up on that discussion. Commissioner, come on around here. We got a couple of chairs.
That one's wired.
Just for you.
Thank you, Don.
Okay, let's turn to agenda item updates and reports. We'll start with our council membership committee, chaired by Leland Myers, and have them report on council membership.
We had several people that were up for, their terms were up. All the positions that were up were associated with a group that nominated them, or a county or something. And so letters were provided by Great Salt Lake, by the Brian Sheriff Ministry, Great Salt Lake Artemia, and Box Elder County, and Tooele County, and the Public Health Treatment Works. And in those regards, Don Leonard, Jeff Scott, Dan Tuttle, and Leland Myers were all reappointed. And those have been confirmed by the Senate. We also have a notification that Tom Ward's reappointment will go into the Senate in October. So we should be almost full. The only one we'd be missing probably is a Weaver County rep, since Commissioner Gibson left. That doesn't necessarily mean he's automatically out, because he hasn't sent us some clothes. He's out either.
So you serve until your replacement's appointed,
right,
in essence.
A few weeks ago, the governor appointed me as one of the new commissioners for UTA. Mm-hmm. And that appointment is up for consideration by the Senate in October. But if that becomes the case, then that would be my new full-time appointment. I'd be leaving Salt Lake County, so.
So we can go up and lobby against is that what you're suggesting?
I was just going to suggest that we might have a vacancy here, but I can, and we have a little bit undecided until the November election in Salt Lake County, but I can have somebody come as a non-voting person to represent me. Until something permanent gets established.
You can actually have an alternate in your role as a county person, so you could actually have someone appointed as your alternate then.
Okay. Do you just need a letter, or what do you need to solidify?
You just need to notify us who it is.
Okay.
And then
it'd be Will Summercorn, who's my director of planning and transportation, but he's familiar with the commission and their work.
So the only thing is, if you submit a letter of resignation, they can serve until they replace.
Until they replace. Okay, that'd be a good solution.
Earl, I think we'd have to adjourn permanently if you could lose you at the very beginning.
I think life might even get better for you.
No, just the opposite.
Congratulations,
anyway,
that's a challenging position.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting.
Not a cupcake job like this one.
I don't know, this one has some pretty tough problems to solve.
Well, thank you, Carlton, appreciate that. And thanks to Lena, who's done a lot of bird dogging to get those reappointments approved. And I know that a number of them were for third terms, which typically don't happen, so Lena has a lot of pull.
Yeah, you're right.
Just take credit. Okay, more questions about the membership? Let's go into another updated report regarding allocation of appropriations. At our last meeting, we had, as I mentioned, a lengthy conversation. We specifically appropriated $25,000 of our $125,000 appropriation in support of two papers, one a survey of drying lakes and consequences of that happening, And then two, costs of the Grind Great Salt Lake. Since our last meeting, Marcel's continued to raise money. She's getting close to the magical number, thanks to those who have agreed to participate. I will note that both the Division of Water Resources and Forest Fire State Lands agreed to contribute $15,000 each to the second paper, the cost of a drying Great Salt Lake. So we're close to our, very close to our magic number there. We've also been in the process of preparing RFPs, and they're nearly complete. And anticipate them going out very soon, within a week or two. And we've been working with the state of Utah on the appropriate process for each of these papers. And because of the cost of them, the nature of them, they may be handled differently. But in either case, it would be helpful to have a review committee to review submissions and to help select the provider. We don't need a large one, but since the council is the one sponsoring and hosting these papers and these efforts, much as we've done in the past, I'd like to see if there are a couple of council members who'd like to join me on that committee. Anyone interested to help select?
I'll do it if no one else can.
So be quiet if you want, Leland. Hurry and volunteer if you don't.
I love the idea of Leland.
Leland? Anyone else? Tom, how about you? Is that where you volunteering?
I will second Leland's.
Need another one?
I think he volunteered.
Is that what I just did?
Yeah.
I will help for you.
Thank you. Okay, we're good. Thank you. We also had conversations about...
Let me just review the totals again. The total cost was $150,000.
I don't think we have a total cost. As we talked to people, it's very little bit. I think our guesstimate was that the survey was 15, no more than 20,000, maybe less. And the other paper, because it involves actually creating rather than just reviewing data, maybe closer to the 70, 80, 90 range. So somewhere maybe total between 100 and 120 for both papers.
So the RFPs will go out even if not all funding is in hand?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're close enough.
Okay. So,
and the way the bid process works, you don't really say we have $70,000 to spend.
Sure.
You say, here's what we need to have done. What's it going to cost us? So that's why I hesitated about getting on the phone. I appreciate the number of folks who stepped up. And once we get it all together, we'll let people know how it's being allocated and how much to each one. So
the new $5,000 from the Foundation in addition to R15.
And a couple others are pending. We're just waiting for a final review before we announce it. So. Okay, we also appointed a committee chaired by Leland to look at allocating $50,000 to some nutrient research, and he's in conversations with DWQ and hope to have a specific response at the next meeting. We talked about setting aside some funds, perhaps about $20,000, to find another good paper project, if you will, and that would leave us about $35,000 for other projects that he might propose for us to consider. So I think at our November meeting, we'll have a really substantive conversation to try to finalize those decisions. Yes.
Is that kind of living with the Water Quality Board? Or is that already kind of settled, that dollar amount?
For the $50,000? No, we haven't touched it. We haven't approached the Water Quality Board.
So this is an appropriation from the legislature diverting brine shrimp royalties to the advisory council.
Okay, just double check if I'm the chair of the Water Quality Board. I'm trying to stay on that if they keep me on the Board of Health, so just keep me in the loop.
Okay. We'll do. Okay. Thank you. Any other comments or questions about that project? Okay, let's move to the next item. A number of meetings ago, we determined that we need to, because of the statutory provision that the Great Salt Lake technical team is a technical or scientific advisor to the advisory council, we determined that we would entertain some brief summary reports of research reports that were given to the technical team. And we've invited Jake and Laura each meeting to do so. I think I'll ask Jake to go first today. Jake's going to talk to us a little bit about research study regarding microbialite response to salinity in the Great Salt Lake.
Sure.
And then after Jake, we'll have Laura talk to us about Phragmites revegetation techniques, a study by Karin Kettenring and Emily Martin. So, Jake, you're on first.
Okay. Normally, I study while Laura goes, so this will be harder.
I'm studying.
This is a study from Melody Lindsay, who was a PhD student at Montana State University, but in collaboration with Bonnie Baxter, who works a lot on the Great Salt Lake, and looking at microbialites and differences between microbialites that are currently occurring in the North Arm versus the South Arm. And so their main goal was to determine whether that salinity difference between the two arms influences the communities that live on those microbialites, as well as to determine if microbialites in the South Arm versus the North Arm are still actively building, or whether they're remnants of previous microbial activity. So to answer that question, they collected microbialite structure samples from the North and South Arms. They then extracted and analyzed DNA samples from both sets of samples, and analyzed the DNA, or analyzed the communities based on the DNA that was present. And they also analyzed the different types of minerals that are present on the microbialite structures as another indicator of biological activity occurring on those structures. So what they found was some really distinct differences between the microbial communities occurring in the North Arm and the South Arm on those structures. In particular, photosynthetic taxa were present in abundance in the South Arm, but were essentially absent in the North Arm microbialites. Similarly, they found evidence of mineral structures occurring on the South Arm microbialites that are typically associated with biological activity. And so those two pieces of evidence combined suggest that the South Arm microbialites are still actively growing and actively colonized and developing, as opposed to the North Arm microbialites, which are likely to be remnant structures, sort of recolonized by other taxa not associated with the formation of those structures. So,
yeah. Thank you. Any questions?
All right. Most of you know that Karin Kettenring up at Utah State has been doing Phragmites research around the Great Salt Lake. She's been doing that since 2012. We had her first looking at how to effectively treat Phragmites, and I think we can all agree that that starts with summer mowing, followed by a three-year sequence of fall spraying glyphosate, and winter mowing in a three-year succession. But the problem is that the litter still remains for years, especially without water, once the Phragmites has been killed and is dying, or is on laying dry on the land. And so they looked at ways to get rid of or remove some of the dead Phragmites, and they're using two strategies, rolling and crushing with some heavy equipment, kind of like a big snowcat, and then mowing and removing. And so those are the two treatments. And in her most recent research that was with FY17 Tech Team Funds, she looked at techniques for successful revegetation of native plants in Great Salt Lake wetlands to prevent Phragmites reinvasion and restore avian habitat. And so with these two treatment techniques, they also used some approach, or they approached revegetation with seeds in two different ways. One, they used a tackifier. They sprayed seeds using this tackifier onto Phragmites and onto the soil, and then evaluating the utility of mulching for maintaining moist soil conditions. And what they found, or what the take-home points were for the stem density of native plants, was that the mow and remove litter treatments is superior to the roll and crush treatment in enhancing native plant stem density for alkali bulrush, hard stem bulrush, saltgrass, and to a lesser extent, three-square bulrush. Seeding increased stem density with native species overall, with the exception of Baltic rush, which had very low stem density. The timing of seed sowing and the mulch treatment didn't have a large effect on stem density of all native species, and Phragmites stem density was relatively high overall and not impacted by increasing stem density of native species. Surprise, surprise. The kind of take-home points was that the cover of native species was quite low across all treatments except for saltgrass, Salt grass was higher in the mow and remove litter treatments regardless of seed treatment. And Phragmites cover was somewhat reduced in the rural and crush treatments relative to mow and remove treatments. And in the mow and remove treatments, Phragmites cover was slightly reduced when native species were added. And how this, what the implications are for managers, we're looking at the results of this study. They conclude that mowing and removing Phragmites litter treatment is important for establishing appreciable amounts of native plants. No difference in seed treatments and timing and mulch addition didn't matter for native plant stem density cover. And native plant covers were lower overall despite their introduction through seeding when compared to Phragmites. And the abundance of Phragmites in the research plots highlights the importance of greatly reducing Phragmites in the seed bank and existing rhizome network prior to the seed sowing. So if Phragmites are still present, reseeding is going to be difficult, I think is the bottom line, the research.
Questions? Comments?
Any sense of where the litter was removed to? Is it just burned or?
No, I think that it was still within the WMA test plot, or within the WMAs where they had the test plots.
Is there that one notion of feeding it to cattle, spraying it with molasses, and that's wasn't part of the research?
No, it wasn't part of the research, but feeding Phragmites to cattle is being done, so.
Oh, did the study address, or maybe it's already been looked at in terms of once you have a native stand established, can that keep the Phragmites out? You mentioned the reseeding of the Phragmites there. How about once you've obtained a stand?
Is there I don't think they've gotten to that point yet, okay. Because I don't think they're only looking at treating the frag first, not how to prevent it first from step. Encroaching on native seeds. Hopefully we get to that point where we're trying to keep it out instead of fighting it back.
Another question? Thanks, Jason. I appreciate that very much. At the outset, I failed to go around the room and have people introduce themselves, and I'd like to do that. I'll mention that there is a clipboard going around. You're not allowed to leave the room unless your name's on the clipboard. So please make sure you sign before you leave. Let's start over in the corner, Joey.
Jody Garber, Waterfall, Division Waterfall.
Chris Montague, Nature Conservancy.
Karen Nichols, HDR.
Tom Tripp, U.S. Magnesium.
Nika Roundy, Davis County.
Dan Strickle, Legal Wind Voters.
Ryan Doherty, Cardio.
Catherine Daly, Environmental Dispute Resolution Program.
John Ramori, Environmental Dispute Resolution Program.
Nick Scow, Utah Rivers Council.
Linda Freitas, Friends of Great Salt Lake.
Krishna Kapri, Division of Water Resources.
Amy DeFries, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Joe Havis, Compass Minerals.
Laura Ault, Forestry Fire. Jamie Martin, Forestry Fire and State Land.
Jack and Wiker, Jacobs.
Long John Forest, Upstate Sewer District.
Corey Angeroff, the U.S. Geological Survey.
Candace Hassenager, Division of Water Resources.
Ryan Cotton from the Division of Forestry Fire and State Lands.
Scott Sieber, National Audubon Society.
Steve Erickson, Utah Audubon Council.
Chris Peterson, interested. Sportsman and rancher.
Laura Vernon, Forestry Fire and State Lands.
Jake Vanderlaan, Division of Water Quality.
Jared Hess, Weber Basin Water.
John Perry, Weber Basin Water.
Jeff Scott, Fox River County.
Leland Myers, Publicly Owned Treatment Works.
Don Leonard with the Brine Sugar Industry.
Jeff Richards, Migratory Bird Protection Areas.
Myron Bateman, Tooele County Commission.
Dave Livermore, Nature Conservancy.
Carlton Christensen with Salt Lake County.
Tom Ward, Municipal Representative.
Thank you. Did we get everyone? Great. Thank you all for being here. One other brief request. Nika, where are you, Nika? we handed out an announcement of an activity that the Sentimental Fountain has going. Nika, would you just briefly comment on that? Thank
yes.
you for what it is.
So thank you. Please refer to this little flyer that we have here on Saturday, September 22nd. The Friends of Antelope Island Group is sponsoring a benefit concert. Proceeds will go to projects at Antelope Island. Specifically, we've got some big ideas coming up to benefit the visitor experience there. 7 o'clock, White Rock Bay, and the entertainment is the National Parks Band. And they're pretty popular, so if you talk to you go guys as folks that you know, and your kids, they all know who these folks are. They've got their own genre going on here, and they're pretty excited to come, and we're pretty excited to have them. And they are semi-local to Utah, and so we're glad that they are performing in their own state. So you can get tickets online, friendsofantelopeisland.com. The ticket online is $20, and that includes your park entry fee. If you come out the night of, you have to pay the park entry, and then you can come buy your ticket for $20 at the venue. So if you have any questions, let me know.
Sounds like a wild party there, Nathan.
Us and the bison. Yep.
Great, thank you. Okay, the issue of water reuse has been growing in interest, and for Great Salt Lake interest, some concern. So we thought it would be useful to educate ourselves a little bit about what's going on with that issue. Weber Basin Water Conservancy District has a feasibility study underway, and Assistant General Manager Darren Hess agreed to come and visit with us about that. So Darren?
Okay, great.
Thank you for being here.
Should I stand? Might be a little easier to hear me.
However you're comfortable.
Stand over there. So.
Do that or speak loudly.
Or both.
Okay. Either way, it doesn't matter to me.
Can
you guys hear me okay?
Okay.
So I appreciate the invite, and we're happy to just discuss a little bit more about what Weber Basin is working on in terms of our drought contingency plan, as well as our feasibility study that we've been doing on water reuse recycling. So with that, I'll just talk a little bit about our drought contingency plan that we've just recently completed. In 2012-2013, we had a very poor winter. We only stored a little less than 16,000 acre feet in our upstream reservoirs. We have total contracts of 225,000 acre feet to deliver. And so we got really concerned when we're only storing 16,000 acre feet and we have to deliver 225. 90,000 of that are contracts to municipal and industrial customers. And so that's quite a firm supply that we have to supply. We also, you know, Weber Basin Water, I mean, we're a large water purveyor in northern Utah. A lot of our water is wholesale water to different cities and water districts that actually retail potable water. We wholesale that to them. That's that 90,000. And then we also have secondary retail connections. We supply about 18,000 secondary retail connections. And then we also have a large contingency of ag water that we deliver on a wholesale basis to different agencies and entities as well on the ag side. And then on the secondary side, we wholesale a lot of water to other irrigation districts that then retail that water on the secondary irrigation side. And then we have a lot of replacement water contracts in the upper mountain valleys. Summit County, Morgan County deliver a lot of water up there through wells that people drill. So just to give you an idea of where we deliver water to, we are a junior water right holder on the system. We were created in 1950, and in terms of water, that's kind of late to the game. So we are a junior water right holder. And then with the drought that happened in 2012 through 2015, we did implement restrictions in 12, 2013, 14, and 15. So that was, typically that's a 20% cut in all of our ag contracts that we cut. And then also we cut the season off 2 weeks early in those years, similar to like we're gonna do this year. We're gonna cut the irrigation off October 1st this year as well, because of the low storage in our reservoirs with the hot, dry summer that we had, and not knowing what the next winter is going to bring, we feel it's prudent that we cut that off early. So this is just to show you just kind of a drought history, really from 1970 to today. And really, just maybe look at this green line. You can kind of see, you know, the drought. We had some drought period there, late 80s, early 90s. But essentially, you know, from the year 2000 back, you know, we had maybe 5 or 6 years where we didn't fill. 77 was a really dry year that we had. And then we had a little drought there for the late 80s, early 90s. So we had about 6 years we didn't fill our reservoir. The green line is the total reservoir storage for Weber Basin. Then you can see since 2000, it's been a lot more variable. We had the drought in the early 2000s, and then we had the drought here from 2012 to 2015. 2017 was a great year. 2011 was a great year. But you can see, you know, about 12 out of the last 18 years, we have not filled, you know, our storage on our reservoirs. So you can see, I mean, it's getting a lot more. I mean, we do have a good year every now and again. 2011 was a great year. 2017 was a good year. But it appears like we're going to have more of these drought cycles with a good year, you know, interspersed in between. And we kind of hear that with climate change going on, bigger storms, you know, larger hurricanes as things are warming up. You know, it's going to be more variable, it looks like, moving forward into the future. And so we want to be able to plan for that. Again, that's just zooming in on that 77 drought. We just found this old photo that we had. We are not watering this lawn and these shrubs this year, 1977, because of the water shortage. It's a little hard to see, but anyway, it's kind of funny. We found that sign. That was at Weber Basin headquarters. And then that's just to zoom in and kind of show you just the variability that we've been seeing, you know, since 2000. So you're all, I'm sure, familiar with this and just the level of the Great Salt Lake. It just kind of shows the variability. Interesting to note that, you know, when we had this low point in the 60s, 63, 64 time period, that was a really dry period, obviously, for the Wasatch Front. And so 61, 62, 63 was very dry, so obviously that makes sense that that coincides. And as we've looked at our drought contingency plan, you know, we've seen droughts 3-4 years long since 2000. But as we went back in the paleo record and looked at you know, some of the studies, we've seen that they had 7, 8, 10 year droughts, you know, back in the 1600s, which, you know, could definitely happen in the future, and we need to prepare for and be ready for. And so as we looked at our drought contingency study, you know, we're definitely mindful of that. That's the Dust Bowl in the 30s, that historic low in 63, and then the drought between 01, 04. This just shows our current usable reservoir capacity is about 400,000 acre feet. The typical year yield that we see when we do have a typical year, which, like I said, those are not very often, is about 207,000 acre feet. And then in 2013, total yield of the project was 41,000 acre feet. So that's total yield that came out of the project. And so it just shows you, you know, during these low years, you know, we are highly concerned when the project is yielding numbers like that, and we have to deliver contracts. You know, M&I contracts, 90,000 acre feet, and then total contracts, 225,000 acre feet. So, I mean, there's definitely, you know, we definitely have a problem there. And then the recycled water project, this would be just give you a scale of kind of what we're looking at. You know, we don't know exactly how many acre feet we're talking about on a recycled water project, but that's our best guess, you know, right now. That's just because it gives you an idea of kind of what we're looking at. But the reason that recycled water is appealing is that, unlike the previous slide where you can't depend on that water, you know, recycled water in any given year, the yield is the same as your project capacity. And then in a drought year, you still have that same water available to you. That water, it's a lot more resilient to your weather patterns than any other source of water that we could go after. And so that's why it is definitely appealing in a drought scenario, and we assume moving forward we are going to have more of these drought scenarios. So so this idea of one water, you know, we realize that we are in a closed basin. You know, we all have to work together on this issue to make sure the health and vitality of the Great Salt Lake continues. I mean, all of us want to make sure, you know, that we have a healthy Great Salt Lake because of all the other issues that we're aware of if we don't. And the fact that, you know, it is a connected water cycle. I mean, when anybody potentially drills a well, builds a reservoir, takes, you know, a field of sagebrush up in Wyoming and converts that to ag lands, all of that is taking water potentially away from the Great Salt Lake. Regardless of what, you know, what one individual is doing, I mean, all of those things impact the Great Salt Lake. And obviously the Bear River, you know, is a huge contributor to the Great Salt Lake. You know, this was the study done by Water Resources with help from others. And, you know, this study says 58% is coming from the Bear, 15% from the Weber, and then Jordan River, 22%. And that, just the whole idea that we are all connected, and that, you know, if somebody up in the Bear River, up in Wyoming or Idaho, you know, converts sagebrush to farmland and starts irrigating that ground that hasn't historically been irrigated, that impacts the Great Salt Lake, you know, just as much as, you know, drilling a well necessarily or building a reservoir. But the issue again with building a reservoir is during those low water years, there's no, you know, commitment or, you know, it's not going to be a positive situation if we can't fill that reservoir. That's going to be an issue for us. So you could spend millions of dollars trying to do that, and then in a dry year, you know, there's no water for that reservoir. So it really didn't help you in that case. This just kind of shows the Weber Basin's system that we have. Just to explain a little bit, as water comes down the Weber River, it combines with the Ogden, as you're aware, the Slaterville Diversion, and then the yellow are canals that Weber Basin has. So that's the Willard Canals that delivers water to Willard Bay. And so we have obligations to deliver water to the Ogden Bay Bird Refuge here at the end of the Weber River. We also have obligations to deliver water to the Harold Crane Waterfowl Management Area. And then also during the flood years of 11 and 17, so we are able to divert water out to the Willard Canal, out to Willard Bay, and take pressure off of these lands here as far as flood, you know, flooding is concerned. Take water north out to Willard Bay, and then out of the north side of Willard Bay, we dump that into the Willard Spur. So if Willard Bay is full, or we think Willard Bay could fill during a flood situation, we start dumping water early. And again, we run 1,000 CFS out to Willard Bay and dump that in the north arm of the Willard Spur. We're currently lining the Willard Canal, getting it to a 2,000 CFS capacity so that we can double the capacity now that we can take out to Willard Bay, and then double the capacity that we can eventually dump out to the Willard Spur in a flood situation, since these good years look like they're really good years, you know, based on what we've seen. And we need to take pressure off of the lower Weber in terms of flooding. And that's the main avenue to take flooding pressure off the lower Weber, is take it out there. Now, you know, it's over $1,000 a foot to line the Willard Canal. And we do a project every year. We just bid it out, didn't we?
We did. $2.2 million.
$2.2 million to do 2,000 feet. And so, you know, we've been doing that for the last 7, 8, 9 years now. We've probably got another 10 to 12 years left, maybe more. We're hoping we can get more footage there. But in conjunction with Weber County, you know, in 2011, when we had all the flooding issues, we decided to redo the diversion structure right here that delivers water out to Willard Bay, so we could take that 2,000 CFS And then, like I said, we're lining the canal to be able to do that. So it is a process, though. It does cost lots of money to line that canal.
You have to do that during the winter time?
Only during the winter time as well. So that's also the restriction that we have, yeah. We have about till October, from October the 15th to about January 1st. It's kind of the window we can give them. If there's any water coming down the system after the 1st of January, well, we're missing out on water, you know, too, that could go to Willard Bay during that time period. But after the 1st of January, especially if it's a low year, we've got to make sure we store that water in Willard. And so yeah, it's a small window that we give the contractor. That's the other problem that we have. So on the feasibility study, this was, again, we were curious to see if recycled water would fit into, you know, our water supply portfolio and how it would fit, what it would cost, you know, what would a project look like. And so we did apply for a USBR funded project, and it did get funded. And so we are studying, you know, the wastewater treatment plants, the water that comes off of those plants in the Weber and Davis County area. There's five wastewater treatment plants, South Davis in the south, Central Davis there, North Davis there, and then Central Weber in the north. And so what we're looking at is, obviously water rights is a big issue. We're looking at how much water from, you know, Weber Basin water rights flows to each one of these wastewater facilities, because that's really the only water that we can utilize. And then we're taking a look at the existing water rights that are already associated with these wastewater treatment facilities. And then also considering potential impacts to the Great Salt Lake as part of this process. And as we've looked at, again, we're right now in the feasibility study. We're about 6 months in. You know, we probably have another 6 to 8 months left, something like that, before we finish the study. So I really don't have anything concrete necessarily, but you know, I can say that as we've looked at these wastewater treatment facilities, there is appreciable water that Weber Basin has that flows through those facilities. But with other water rights that have been filed on that water for environmental flows, and then with just not enough water that we think that to maybe justify a project, we really feel like these wastewater treatment facilities, both the South Davis, Central, and North Davis, we probably won't try to do any sort of recycled water project with those wastewater facilities. So I think the only one really that we have left is Central Weber that we would be looking at to work with. I mean, we've kind of ran some numbers, and anyway, we just feel like it may be in the best interest of everybody, Great Salt Lake included, if we don't try to go after the water that's going through those wastewater facilities. So it looks like Central Weber is probably the potential project that we could look at. And so you're familiar with the indoor water uses that we have, and you know, that when we get up and shower and get ready for the day, you know, about 95% of this water returns back to the system. Only 5% of this water is depleted. So 95% of this water returns back to the wastewater facility and goes to the wastewater treatment plants. So it's depleted about 5% then for indoor. Outdoor, with studies that we've looked at and researched, we feel like that number is closer to 95% depleted when people sprinkle it on their lawns and gardens. I mean, if you think about, you know, your own house and lawn, you know, let's say you do have some overspray, you spray it out into the street, you know, if you're trying to water your park strip, where does that stormwater typically go? You know, typically it goes to a detention or retention basin, sits in that basin and just evaporates or evapotranspirates if it's got grass in that detention or retention basin. But for the most part, you know, it's depleted. It's not returning back to the system. I mean, the root structure of Kentucky bluegrass is 4 inches deep. You know, people are watering their backyards. Pretty difficult, you know, for that water to really make it into the, you know, most of our wells, you know, we pump down to about 1,200 feet is what we're drilling to. You know, we're pulling that water out of deep aquifers. The recharge, you know, from a sprinkler system, you know, up on the surface, we really don't feel is getting down to these deep groundwater aquifers where we're pulling this water out of. So we really feel like, you know, the water that's used outdoors, sprinkled on our lawns, is basically depleted at 95%. And so that's the water that we really need to look at going after and making a change, you know, based on our current practices. This just kind of shows just a water concept that we're talking about here with the recycled water. So as we go through this, so the water goes to the wastewater treatment facility. Then the water would be treated to a type 1 reuse. That water could be directed to the Willard Canal. And then we have, like I said, requirements that we have to deliver water to the Harold Crane waterfowl management area. That water could then be delivered to the waterfowl management area and then not released from our high mountain storage water. That's normally what we would do, is release that water to fulfill that requirement. So that water could go fulfill these environmental requirements. Then we exchange that water. So we're able to exchange that water upstream and pull water out of our upstream reservoirs, deliver that water to our treatment plants, and then treat that water through our water treatment plants. And then as that water is delivered to homes, there is a depletion there. But with, you know, 70% of your homes in Weber-Davis County areas have secondary outdoor water. About 30% or so have potable water going outdoors. Then your depletion, well, if it's all indoor water, 95% of it returns right back to the wastewater treatment facility, okay? If it's being sprinkled outdoors, and we're in that 25 to 30% range, then that water is being depleted, you know, off of those lawns and gardens, and is not returning back to the wastewater treatment facility. But, and it all depends on what that ratio is, but on an average, that's what we're looking at. And so that's kind of what we're keying on, is how much water is really being depleted. Otherwise, that water is just being recycled, you know, through the wastewater treatment facility. And then, you know, the district being a large water district, we are able to supply environmental flow requirements with this. We're not putting it directly into a secondary water system and then just throwing it on lawns and gardens, just depleting it at 95%. I mean, we would be delivering this water for other flow requirements that we have for environmental concerns. Or, I mean, it could be delivered, you know, to a farmer potentially. But we have these requirements already to deliver these out to Harold Crane and Ogden Bay. So we feel like that this is a recycled water concept, you know, kind of 21st century style. And it only works because you have a large water district like Weber Basin Water, and we could team up with a large wastewater facility like Central Weber. And obviously, it's got to have benefits for Central Weber as well. And with the requirements, the phosphorus requirements and whatnot that, you know, that are put upon these wastewater treatment facilities, I think there's a positive relationship that will benefit them as well as benefit the district and really provide a sustainable water supply during a drought scenario. I mean, not just during a drought scenario, but it is a much more sustainable water supply potential that we're talking about. And so I wanted to just, you might have seen this clip with the gentleman in Murray, and I just, this kind of just points out the depletion issue that we have with, let's see if I can get it to play here. So I thought this was interesting when we saw this here on the news. So
We're using too much water. We're just simply trying to keep our yard green.
In fact, that man using 10%, that's the amount a Murray homeowner will pay this month for his water.
I am not a water waster. It's not like we're using too much water. We're just simply trying to keep our yard green.
Let's make sure we can play this.
In fact, that man using 10% less water than he did last year.
New at 6, new specialist Jed Bull's live to tell us why that man is now paying 50% more. Jed?
Yeah, Deanie. Murray Water changed its billing this summer to a 5-tiered rate structure to comply with state law aimed at conserving water. The more you use, the more you pay exponentially, as detailed in this flyer that went out to all customers in April. But that surge in cost was just too much for one customer.
It's not like we're using too much water. We're just simply trying to keep our yard green.
Alma and Karen Hansen are passionate about their beautiful yard.
It's very peaceful and it's nice.
They spend hours manicuring the property that measures 2/3 of an acre.
I am not a water waster.
This month, they're also spending $662 on water. That's a 51% increase over last year when they used 10% less.
The last two bills I have were both more than 50% higher than they were last year.
Hanson understands the rate change, but
it just seems unfair to me that they can just arbitrarily decide that now we're going to charge you an extra $300 to $400 a month penalty for simply trying to water my lawn.
He's obviously been, you know, used to using a lot of water.
The director of Murray Public Works tells me Hanson uses 4 times more than the average Murray water user, who should be seeing about a 10% increase in the bill.
Most of his water usage is going to end up in that very highest tier.
The most expensive water.
It's all based on conservation.
If he wants to pay less, the water manager says, Hanson will have to cut back.
Slowing that flow just a little bit more.
Which Hanson says will be difficult.
Well, I've done everything in my power just because I don't want to pay extra if I don't need to pay extra.
The city is eager to meet with him.
We need to have our people go out and meet with him and see if we can help figure this out for him.
Yeah, the city wants to send out a water tech to meet with Hanson and talk with him about some strategies for reducing that extremely expensive bill. Guys?
Jim Bolt, live for it.
So, I know all he's trying to do is just, you know, irrigate his lawn, right? But it just points to the, you know, I'd love my daughter to get married in his backyard as well. You know, that's a really nice place. I'm not arguing with that. It's nice. But the fact that, you know, we have, you know, these sorts of landscapes that, you know, he's applying a lot of water, obviously, because he's in that highest tier. I mean, $662 a month, that's a pretty good bill for his water. But what we're saying is, I mean, we just need to combine forces here and continue to make improvements initially on, you know, city ordinances to not let this sort of landscaping go in the way it's going in. And then obviously provide incentives for, well, he's getting an incentive right now, right, as far as the cost to reduce his water use, but provide incentives for other individuals to reduce this landscaping, because this is really the problem. 95% of that water is just being depleted. We can withstand a lot more of the indoor water use because it's returning back to the system. You know, there's a lot of, you know, higher density going in right now in a lot of areas. Well, it's a lot of indoor use, you know, with very little outdoor use in some of these large complexes. But I think we can handle a lot of that because a lot of that water is going back to the system. It's the large landscapes that we can't deal with. So anyway, I think that was basically my last slide here. So yeah, I think this is it. So just in summary, we know we have a problem with the Great Salt Lake. We know the importance of it as far as the birds, brine shrimp, minerals, recreation. We know all the public health issues with all the past history, the use and return flows, like I talked about, indoor, outdoor, those depletion issues. And then sources for new development are scarce. And I think, you know, the public seeing that we are pursuing a recycled water project will help them understand that this water, it's not just an endless supply. I mean, there's a finite amount. And I don't think a lot of people even think about how much water comes off the system in a given year versus, you know, the kind of contracts we have to supply. I mean, nobody even gives it a second thought. And so I think if they see that you know, we're looking at doing something like this, in their mind, as far as conservation, maybe something will click that hasn't clicked to say, hey, we need to work together and you know, reduce the flow. And then sustainable landscapes are the big issue here. The local scapes, you know, that we're pushing and working on with Jordan Valley, city ordinance changes, and then education. I mean, we just need to push that as quickly and as fast as we possibly can. And then, you know, our secondary metering project, you know, where we've got about 7,000 meters installed right now. You know, we, on an average, we're saving 35%. Last year, we saved 50%. Those that had a meter versus a non-meter saved 50% on their water use. And that was just sending them a monthly statement, educating them on their use. We're not changing their bill or anything. We're just educating the public on how much water they're using. And, you know, as soon as 2017 comes and they see, oh, it's a good water year, those without a meter, their use just spikes. Those with a meter, it goes up, but it's much more tapered. The slope on that line is a lot less. Nobody knows, right, what I'm doing. I'm going to help Weber Basin out with their flood control by applying that water to my landscape. You know, it's kind of what they're thinking. And, you know, early season flood year, you know, yeah, it probably does help us a little bit, you know, because we're looking for places to put water, right? But come July 1st, you know, we're looking for water anywhere we can find it. And in the dry years, we're looking for it all year long. So with that, yeah.
Thank you. Questions from council members first?
I mean, you're metering it, but do you anticipate having some kind of rate structure associated with that, or is it politically just not palatable?
Yeah, no, we're currently working on a project that is setting a rate for us for the secondary water systems, yeah. And we would probably initially apply that on new construction. All new construction would get a secondary water rate and be billed for it. And then we just feel like, you know, we have 18,000 connections, we're 7,000 now. We feel like we need to get over the 50% level, or we'd have a lot of people saying, why are you billing me? This is unfair, you know, just because you installed a meter on my lot first. We think there'd be a lot of public pushback there, but we want to start it on new construction because there's no prior, you know, precedent there. Let's install it on them first, and then slowly it'll migrate into the existing users as well. Yeah.
Oh, Darren, one of the things that we've been looking at, and I think a lot of individuals have had, water rights or water to the Great Salt Lake, and I'm really excited about how you've approached it in terms of a win for the upstream, and also I see a dedicated flow to the lake.
Right.
Is that how's the water that would flow to the lake from the reuse, is that a new water right, or you talked about an exchange? What is that mechanism, and I guess the part that intrigues me, it appears to be like a perpetual, just as you'll have a reliable supply up above, but then the lake will have a reliable supply coming from that treatment plant.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, we're able to just, because we have those deliveries that are necessary on the bottom end, both to Ogden Bay and Harold Crane, we can take water we would normally release out of the reservoirs upstream. Now we can deliver that with water that we treat and take it into the Willard Canal. So we can treat that water, deliver it there. It will still be released, you know, from the upper, but it released for indoor use, hopefully more so, to our treatment plants, and then hopefully 95% of that water comes back to the system, and we just pull it off again. So there is a depletion. Anybody that sprinkles their outdoor lawns and gardens with potable water, there is going to be a depletion there in that 95% range. But again, most of those houses have a secondary water component on outdoor use, about 30% water with culinary water. But yes, that's the idea, is that we would, you know, bake that exchange and deliver that water out to those areas.
That's just
That's on under an existing water right that already goes to the wildland.
That's correct. That's an existing water right that we already have to deliver.
Do you see an opportunity to use the same framework to create dedication of new flows to the lake in terms of development?
I think that is definitely a possibility. You know, that is definitely on the table and that we're looking at to try to make sure that we maintain the vitality of Great Salt Lake. Yeah.
I'm just writing that down with quotes for
you. We got you recorded there.
Yeah. So, Darren, is this one of the items you might see on the agenda came from some conversation that Jeff and some others here had that spurred in terms of there's a lot of ideas on how to put water in the Great Salt Lake, but there's no policy that says you have to. I mean, your policy for your department is to get water for the customers and make that happen.
Right.
There's a lot of ways that we could get water to the lake, but there's no policy that says you have to put water in the lake.
Right.
Do you see, how do you see this fitting within that? And then also, because your other big projects, the Bear River, that we're very interested in from a Great Salt Lake perspective.
Right, right. I mean, this is definitely another incremental step to continue to push out the Bear River Project. I mean, because we all know the Bear River Project is going to have an impact, you know, to the Great Salt Lake. It definitely will. So this is another interim step, you know, to continue to push out the Great Salt Lake or the Bear River Project, so that we don't, you know, have to incur those costs, those issues, and things. I mean, are we going to be able to have a dedicated supply that will only go to the Great Salt Lake? That we don't know, you know. I mean, our first priority is to provide the water to, you know, individuals that live in this area. That's our first priority. But if we can, you know, meet both purposes at the same time, really it's the landscape that have to change so that we can have water that will go to Great Salt Lake. I mean, we can't keep doing what we're doing, you know. And I see a lot of new construction right now, and I see a lot of yards. I mean, everybody spends all their money on their house, right? They try to eke out as much as they possibly can, and then there's just no money left over for that landscape. And so, but mama doesn't want the kids tracking in dirt, right, into her brand new house. So she's like, get that dirt covered up as fast as possible. And the cheapest thing to do is to put turf in. There's a financial problem there, you know, that everybody has when they try to do a landscape. And we're trying to make that more affordable. We're trying to educate people on local scapes. But really, the cities have to come on board. And Scott and I went around, and we met with every city here a year ago and went over the whole conservation, you know, ideas and things. We gave them model landscape ordinances that they could put, you know, in their ordinances. But it is moving slow, you know. Nobody really wants to, or seems to want to make changes in that regard. I mean, we even approached, you know, our legislators that are developers and said, hey, we want to do a model home in your development with a local scape. We'll pay for all the landscaping. We just want to do it, you know. And we were turned down by the legislator. Said, "No, I don't want that sort of landscape in my model home." And so we have to make inroads there. And we're hoping legislators would support us in some of these things. So we'll continue to hit up additional legislators and developers that will help us in that regard, because that's where we have to make hay is right there, you know. And I realize it's a fact. Very few people have a lot of money left over for landscaping, and there is an initial expense for all those trees and shrubs. I mean, those cost money, you know, and so can you step that and do it over steps? Sure you can, but I know mama doesn't want dirt tracked into her brand new house, so it's a difficult thing.
So I work for municipality, and I've worked for ones in the past.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're looking at, how do you make that next step? And so engaging our electeds and then our community. Do you have any examples you'd steer us towards? Our water is off of Metro Salt Lake and Sandy, but I like how you're pointing that out, that it's at the local level makes the land use planning decisions and quality of life.
Yes.
And so it's got to be a partnership with the water districts and the cities, but you can't force them to do that. So we're looking at, well, for Sandy, our next block of water is going to cost us $57 million for just 2,500 acre feet. So that's about $22,000 an acre foot, if you do the math. That's still cheaper than California, $50,000 to $80,000 an acre foot, but it's a lot more than Utah's used to, which is $2,000 to $5,000 an acre foot.
Mm-hmm.
So here all these other, you know, Eagle Mountain and others saying, oh, it's so expensive. It's like, it's just as expensive as the old cities too. So I'm looking at that and I'm like, you know, I can do a lot with $57 million. I can almost do everyone's landscape for that. Right? And I'm not kidding about this.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to figure out, but it's new and we're going to hit the same challenges. And I'm trying to find some examples where someone said, yeah, it worked and it does look nice and it's actually cheaper in the long run. And the young family is just as happy with this landscape. In fact, the water bill is not $600. It's, you know, stays down at $140. But I'm having trouble finding local examples of how that's, you know, we're kind of treading new ground.
Yeah. I know, you know, Jordan Valley has worked with, Garbett Homes? I think it is. They're in Salt Lake County. And they, you know, they were pushing more towards, you know, a community that, you know, was conservation minded. And that's kind of how they were marketing themselves. And so, they've been able to make some inroads, I understand, you know, with Garbett Homes. I think it's Garbett Homes there in Salt Lake County. I was, you know, talking to Jordan Valley about it. Again, we've tried to make some inroads. We've met with city. It seems like it needs to be on the city council level. If the city council buy in to what we're, it seems like it's been difficult on the staff level to get much moving. And we've met, you know, with city managers, public works directors, you know, and they all say, yeah, we need to do that. But ultimately, we just don't see any movement. So I think it needs to be with the elected officials, you know, city council that buys in and says, hey, we need to make changes and direct staff to do so.
We're in Leland here, right?
Yeah.
Okay. No, I was going to ask Leland next.
You know, just a couple of comments, not necessarily questions. You know, the state water plan assumes or hopes to assume that growth would be covered by conservation, so that existing supplies, including reuse, are not taken back out, because your highest demand period is during the summer when it is going to water use, outside water use.
Right, right.
The higher level of depletion. You know, right now, roughly 9-10% of the water in the Great Salt Lake is out of wastewater facilities. And so that's a sizable chunk of water that could be lost if it goes into reuse that is then depleted through irrigation systems. And so, you know, I don't question, when we were working on the state water plan, I don't question the fact that there's going to have to be ordinances. And I think that that's appropriate to make those changes. It's not going to go away by just hoping it will. And so ultimately, it's going to have to be a legislative fix.
Right, right.
To make this happen, it's going to have to be a legislative fix that allows only certain amounts of water to be utilized at any one time for any one lot. And they've done it in other places.
No, they have. And a good first step is all secondary connections to be metered. You know,
right.
You know, Senator Anderegg, he seems, and Representative Hawks, they seem pretty.
When you look at the guy's interview, I mean, it's what else can I do? Well, you can get rid of half of that acre of ground. You know, you could put it into some native landscape that doesn't demand a lot of water.
Yeah. Yeah.
It won't look the same, but it's, you know, I mean, there's a balance between the, you know, we don't want to turn everything into a flaming heated desert and we get some benefit out of irrigation. At the same time, we don't want to increase the amount of irrigation, so
right.
The need is to be able to reduce it. Now, by the way, right now, in the water quality side of it, the phosphorus limit by 2020 goes down to 1. Some communities are going to get away with 2025, but it's going down to 1. If you drop phosphorus limits anywhere below 1, anything significantly below one, then the principal cost for reuse, which is filtration, will have to be done for treatment of the wastewater. And when that happens, wastewater becomes a free commodity for the water purveyor. And it's not just the big districts who have water, it's every city that contributes water to a facility also will be looking at that for reuse. So it's a significant issue for the Great Salt Lake.
Well, that's why, you know, if this project pencils out, I mean, that's why it would pencil out, because it's a benefit to Central Weaver Sewer District.
Yeah, the cost is cheaper today to put a few chemicals in to get it down to one rather than filtration. If you have to go below one, it becomes free.
All right, Dave, and then I think...
I was going to ask the comment, yes.
Oh, okay, great. All right, we're a little past time, Darren. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
It's very interesting. I guess we can go on for a while here.
Yeah.
We may have to have you back.
Anytime.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't let the public have a question. Any question from the... All right.
Nick already worked me over at the Alliance, so...
Yeah. Darren's used to it.
I'll give him a break today. Yeah. You're trailing me? Okay, next on the agenda.
No, he was really nice, by the way. So.
Tom alluded to a conversation we had a couple of meetings ago about our water strategies and how to get them implemented, and the idea was raised by Jeff and Tom. I can't remember who first raised it, but there needed to really accomplish what we're after, there needed to be a statewide policy as to our objectives. And so we asked Tom and Jeff to put together a sample draft letter of what that would entail. That was just a couple days ago sent out to council members. We should have a copy here. We've got some copies Laura's handing out to the public. It is in draft stage. No one's voted to do this or approve it. It's on the agenda for discussion. And I'd ask Jeff and Tom to provide some introductory comments about this.
Yeah, I can start. I think the discussion we had, I believe it was two meetings ago, is that, you know, there are so many different organizations and individuals that are all kind of driving the same direction. Everybody, I think, has principally the same objective in mind, and that is protection of the Great Salt Lake, whether you're a water treatment plant, you know, I mean, broad spectrum of interests all have the same interest in mind. And in a lot of respects, I think a lot of people are kind of moving the same direction with the same ideas. The problem that I think we discussed is that there's no overarching policy, there's no overarching state body that is looking at bringing all of those interests together in a way to look at it holistically. I mean, ripping off what Darren said of it, you know, should there be legislation on water reuse, and how does that relate to all of the other interests that are out there, and how can some of those other interests benefit from what you're trying to do, and vice versa. And so I think the intent of this letter was to kind of tee that up for the governor and to strongly suggest that there is a policy directive that brings those entities and organizations together in a way to frame overall policy.
Thank you, Jeff.
Well, I think beyond the content of the letter, the other part of our conversation we had is, you know, This body reports to the governor and the legislature in terms of a formal way, but the administration comes down to the Department of Natural Resources and people and whatnot. So we had talked about, you know, is this the right time, the appropriate way to communicate the need for policy? But second, I think a sensitivity that ought to start with conversations with, I mean, even to, you know, meeting with Tage and Darren and Weaver Basin, you know, those that have to deal with it and make a win-win-win scenario, so it's not misunderstood, you know, when the governor reads it and then asks Mike Schuyler to come in and talk to him about it. But I think of that, what Jeff mentioned is, you know, a feeling that we have, my sense is we have a list of things that we can do, and they're all really good activities, but when the state engineer reviews a water right application, there's a little bit of loose language that says, look at the environment, but there's no policy that comes from the governor or the legislature saying, yeah, we want to have water in the Great Salt Lake. And that would give clarity, not just to us, but to Darren and his water management team, to the
and equally, or maybe more important, the administrator of that, Department of Water Resources and the Division of Water Rights. So you don't have staff kind of making decisions and then we all get excited and, you know, clamber in. So the other part of that that you might read in the letter, and this is myself speaking, I think you share this, Jeff, is, in fact, this comes out of some conversation I had with water rights staff. If we don't make some changes now, and we're talking about this 20 years from now, it's a fait accompli. There's, you know, you're going to end up having appropriated and having the growth of cities and towns and landscape ordinances that haven't changed. And the decision in my mind really is to our policy level, if we're going to keep the lake full of water, that decision probably needs to happen pretty soon. Maybe it doesn't need to, but the risk is if we're late, we're going to end up like the other half dozen major terminal water bodies in the world that have dried up, and all of the commerce and businesses and the public health problems, that's going to come our way. And then maybe we end up like LA, we end up with a lawsuit, and we're spraying magnesite over the Great Salt Lake to keep from polluting our lungs. So that's maybe, we also talked, I think, Jeff, you mentioned both distilling it down and having some sort of, what was the term you used, kind of a catch, something that kind of gets the attention of the legislator that this is not an issue too, so they understand why it's important and why we should do something now.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I think there is a window of time. I think that the things need to be done, and there's so many different organizations working on, you know, different things. I think if the state waits too long and kind of fails to fill this kind of void of policy, then there will come a time when we are doing something that's very draconian, and, you know, the guy watering his lawn will be, you know, very small compared to, you know, the water changes that will have to come about to protect the Great Salt Lake. And I think when you get to a point where you have to do those things to protect the Great Salt Lake and wildlife and the ecosystem, by the time you're able to take that kind of action, it'll be too late, really. I mean, no matter what you do to try and fix that, it'll be too late. So I think there is a strong sense of urgency that something's got to be done now.
Questions, comments?
I think it's terrific to have this letter. I think it's the book of you, and I'm just wondering if it could be a little more specific in terms of what we're asking the governor to do. It's not just the legislature, it's just to the governor. So it's basically asking him to use his executive authority to convene his agencies to develop a sustainability plan for the Great Salt Lake and whatever that entails. It seemed a little bit more general to me as far as just, you know, sounding the alarm, but then what are we actually asking him to do? That's all. I think it's great to have this.
Other comments, discussion?
Maybe to respond to that, there is statutory authority under the state engineer, specifically in statute, says the state engineer or the governor, in consultation with the state engineer, can close a basin to any future appropriations or restrict deliveries under that basin based upon reasonable science, either because they know it's a problem or because they know it needs to be studied. Now, I know that, a lot of water right attorneys know that, but that's kind of a large, you know, that rides in the face of, you know, some other planning, you know, water management planning and other, that's a big deal to go out that route. I think the first step is to make the attention of, or get the attention and awareness, but on the other hand, having some specifics of what are the issues and what are we asking them to do. I think if I were the governor, I actually would say that. I would say, let's hold off on appropriation until we have the water resources, water rights, and other entities really know what is the right apportionment, so we divide up the pie before it's all going to one entity or other entities, and we don't end up with unintended consequences.
I think it gives some good directions because us who are in the science of water usage realizes that if you encourage these developers to have part of their development low water usage, have like a five-tier system like Murray has, smaller lots, uses a lot more water. People don't, in my area, want to have five 1 acre lots and don't realize that a half acre lot, 3 acre lot, 4 acre lot uses a lot less water. And you need to maybe have some direction like this in order to encourage local politicians to support the idea of looking how we're going to lower the amount of water we're going to use and be able to get more water going into sewer systems so they can be going to the Great Salt Lake and those type of things. Because those are the things that makes it cost effective in order to put in a sewer system is by the size and by looking at the water usage on these lots. Instead of putting water out on the lawns, I think that it's used more domestic inside the house and then goes into a sewer system. Most of it will flow back into the Great Salt Lake. Those are important concepts. So I think this is a great thing to give to the governor and some direction.
Laura.
I just had a question. The letter mentions attachments that will be that provide background information. I was just wondering what those attachments are, what you envision them to be.
I think part of that was to the issue of specifics. We have one point is that those in the room here are pretty well knowledgeable of made great presentations of the current state of science and understanding presented at the forum and otherwise. That's that those types of details and specifics for someone that is in the know, if you will, they can read that in. But for everyone else, they don't get that. So I know it's been the practice of the council to attach copies or executive summary of the two reports that have been commissioned through this body. Those are really good on the economics and the health of Great Salt Lake. There's another study I think underway, and that might be another one. So I think it would be attachments that say, why is there a short time frame to make a decision? What are the recommendations? Is it just, conserve less water, what's the nexus there? I think the other point that I would make is, it's not a matter of just, continuing to have ordinances and landscapings. Without a policy that says keep water in the lake, we're just going to have lots more landscapes that look like Phoenix or Tucson and a dry Great Salt Lake. I think the policy decision is, are we going to have water in the Great Salt Lake and then decide the landscapes we're going to have around that? Because we're going to run out of a water supply at one point, and so we have to decide as a state if we're going to make sure it's going to be in the lake. And ironically, there is actually a considerable amount of existing uses on the lake that aren't recognized in state water rights statute, from the extractive industries, the brine shrimp industries, that will suffer from that.
Yeah, and I think part of it was to point out the economics of the the drivers of the Great Salt Lake. It's just not environmental interest and water use, but it's also a huge economic support to the state of Utah that's derived out of the Great Salt Lake. So I think that was one of the studies we wanted to attach.
If you need help wrangling them or just compiling them, let me know and I'll help get them to go with the letter.
I think the letter is a great letter. If we were to improve it, maybe it would be a direct ask where we say something to the effect that we're willing to work with natural resources to come up with a policy. So that instead of just saying, you need to do this, we're volunteering to be a coordinator for that policy so that we can put something in place working with natural resources try and come up with something that gets a policy that then can be moved forward to specific action. That would be my only suggestion. I mean, I think it's a great matter. I just don't think. And if we want to do a little more, that would be my suggestion.
Other thoughts?
What's the timing for the letter?
Let me make a suggestion here. I like the letter. I like the idea. I like the direction. I like the ask. And at some point in time, it would be very useful for the governor to state that it's state policy to keep water in the Great Salt Lake. I think there have been some good questions about the evidence we'd include with it and how we'd organize that. I think time is of the essence. I don't know if 20 years is the time frame, Tom, but that being said, I don't think 2 more months is going to kill us here. And my suggestion is, we have a number of people who aren't here today. Jeff, I believe, Todd just texted me at 4:30 this morning telling me he had the flu. I wasn't going to be here. Would the authors be comfortable if we ask council members to provide any wording or thoughts or ideas or changes? We'll have Laura help us gather together evidence and then come back with a complete ready-to-go package at the November meeting. Would that, I'm not punting for purposes, but is that a good approach?
I like that.
And I'd ask each of you to take a real careful look. The words are carefully chosen, I think. And it's been through several iterations by the authors, and I do think the comments today would beef it up a little bit. So if you not just put it in your file and forget about it. I think Tom or Jeff, who wants to be the recipient of comments?
I can.
Okay. So I'll send out a copy of this by email after the meeting with a reminder of what we're asking you to do, and Jeff's email address. And let's try to have something packaged up for up or down in November, if that's okay.
One other comment. I wonder if we consider asking for a meeting with the governor to present the letter. And we kind of go through this straight every year, trying to report the legislature, and never really even want us on the agenda. But if you go to the governor, it might give them more play, or even lieutenant governor.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. And the idea that Tom raised about, or Leland, about what are the pre-steps to smooth the way? Who should we talk to before we sit down with the governor? Should we sit down with Mike Styler and Al Metz and lieutenant governor, perhaps, to try to smooth the way for what we intend and not miscommunicate in any way? So I think that strategy of how to go about launching this request, it would be fair game for discussion between now and November as well. Any objection by council members to that approach?
Sounds good.
Can I ask a question then? I guess I know those individuals, and I thought of interacting with them, but I kind of wanted to wait before I reached out to Alan or Mike or any of them. Would we want to wait until we've, you know, thought about it as a body? Or my thought was to just say we're contemplating where we're at in policy. How do you think about that? But if, I think it's better that we wait and sit. That's what I'll do. And then at the next get together. The reason I ask that is there's a lot of water law that's being looked into this session. A whole bunch of them deal on creating new water for water supply, but also water potentially for the Great Salt Lake. And so as we get closer to the legislative session, once the session's running, it's nothing new is going to really happen. You know, it's got to happen before then if it's going to be part of that conversation. So I would just, if...
But this doesn't ask for a specific piece of legislation. This asks for a statewide policy. I think it's
so my question is, does anybody have any problem if individual members happen to have conversations about that we're having a discussion of public policy at the legislative and governor level about water in the Great Salt Lake? If that makes anyone feel uncomfortable, I'll just kind of wait till we meet at our next meeting.
I would say that I think informally, I think it's probably okay, but I think it is important that we have a meeting with, you know, Directors Steinler and Mathis before we give this to the governor, yeah. Because we do report to them. That's our statutory mandate. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't meet with them before.
But the question is, do you do that before we formalize what our ask is as part of the process, or do we formalize what our ask is and go to them and say, we're going to go to the governor, here's what we're going to ask.
I think the last, and then I think you take their input before you go to the governor.
And then we'll have some things to add to it.
Yeah.
I agree with Jeff, yeah.
Okay. All right, great, let's move along. We're about out of time. I have a couple of other things I'd like to cover. Some of you are aware that the University of Utah College of Law has the Wallace Stegner Center for Land Resources and the Environment. And as part of that center, they have an environmental dispute resolution program. Earlier this summer, they hosted a collaboration on the Great Salt Lake. Did anyone participate in that? Tom, are you there? Jeff is there. So if you are, you were there. I was out of town and not able to be there. As a follow-up to that, they've asked whether we would be interested in having them conduct a comprehensive situation assessment. It's very, I can't do justice as to what that is, but in essence, it would, they're looking for conveners of a process whereby they would interview about 60 people about the Great Salt Lake, they'd do some of their own research, and they would generate a report. Initially told me they had funding sources to do that, but my sense is they may also be looking for some funding in the $30,000 range. I indicated to them that I'd visit with you about it and see if you're interested, and if you were, would invite them back for a formal presentation. And that's my question today. Are you interested enough to have them come back and make a formal presentation? Okay, yep. You'd be willing to do that at our November meeting?
I would be willing. And Don, if I can just say, all the conversation today has really emphasized for me, again, there's so much stuff going on. How do these dots connect? And even what would be the request of the governor? It's a huge question. And what could be widely supported policy solutions that could be proposed to the governor? And that's the kind of thing that would come out of the situation assessment we're looking into, is what would be those targeted efforts that we could really get behind and a lot of people could get behind.
I talked to a couple of the folks who aren't here and had no objection to or whoever attended, that's okay. Great, thank you. Last but not least, I'd like to have a public comment period. I know we're running a little bit late here, but let me ask, is there anyone in the public who would like to make a comment to the advisory council today?
Yeah, Tom, just briefly, in regards to the letter, I think it's a great letter, and I understand why it's going to the governor, and all makes sense. And just kind of curious if maybe the council might also want to, you know, reach out to a few legislators, because the executive branch isn't the only one driving policy. I mean, for instance, the governor has a lot of great stuff last year in his budget about water, a lot of real sensible stuff that got largely ignored by the legislative body. I just wonder if might be part of the focus moving forward as well.
I think at least 15 or 20 of our strategies for water for Great Salt Lake involve some legal change to the law or regulation. I think we've adopted that as a strategy, and we will reach out to legislators in support of strategies that are consistent with those in our reports. That's a fair question.
And I think it really kind of highlights that, to put, use your words, there are a lot of dots out there that need to be connected and nobody can connect to them.
Any other comments from the public?
Behind you.
Let me see, rather than call them, let me see how many we have, so I can divide the time up here. One. You're two. There's a second hand over here. Okay, come far away, be as brief as you can, Joe. Go ahead.
I think the letter's great. It's great. I would support the time and stuff in essence. Planning for next year, we're at a kind of turning point. The lake is very low. If we don't get a snowpack this coming year, it's going to feel a lot like 2016, where there are all kinds of issues on the lake that specific year relative to the marina not having enough berth to get in. You know, as an extractive industry, we have our own sort of contingency planning. I'm sure you do on the brown shrimp side. I know the letter is sort of a separate strategy from that, but kind of bring things to light now while you can still plan for budget in 2019. Is important as well. So just bring that up in terms of time and some of the essence.
For purposes of the recorded record, state your name and affiliation.
Joe Havis, you come to
me. In the prior comment?
Nick Scow, Utah Rivers Council.
Thank you. Glad your name and affiliation.
Jan Streichel, the Gloomin Voters. I think it's a great letter too, and I think it's really important. But I'm wondering if there's a way to be a little more specific about what we want the governor to do. We wanted to establish a commission, we wanted to give it to the water committee, or, you know, some way of helping him decide what to do and how to achieve what we're trying to get.
Thank you. Okay, well, thank you.
I have one more comment.
Yes, Leila.
You know, I think it's important that not only does the council have contact with legislators, but everybody in their individual capacities around the outside also should be doing that. We were able to take out about 13 legislators on the lake. We could go talk about the need for water. And the more we do that,
the more they become aware. So I think it needs for not just one contact, but multiple contacts to occur.
Okay, for our next meeting, the Division of Water Quality has asked if they could give us an update on their water quality strategy. Any objection to including them on the agenda? And we'll include a presentation on the environmental dispute resolution. We'll include some reports from the Soil Technical Team. If you have any other thoughts, feel free to share today.
Let's not forget our hydrologic model and the 400,000 that we've advocated for. We still haven't really had a chance to hear how it's being used and what's needed to do more with that tool.
Okay, let me look and see where we're at.
Or for some other meeting, it doesn't have to be November.
Okay, right. Other thoughts? Okay. Apologize for running a couple minutes late, but thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very
much. Entertain a motion to adjourn the meeting.
So moved.
Thank you, Carlton. Leaders, is there a debate? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Any abstentions? Unanimous.
So it's a major contingency of a lot of interaction.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. It's great.